First up, as always on Tuesday, writer Colin Fleming joins us. His new book is out. It is amazing. It's called Sam Cooke, Live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. It's part of the 33 and a third series. He's got more awesomeness in the works and coming soon. Colin, I want to begin by saying this to you. Tell me about yourself.
Rich Guy Kimball, the Sea Dog, arf arf. Half hour of radio power, right?
Yes, oh yes.
Excited. No, we don't mean warning track power. We're talking Dave Kingman, Moonshot, Waveland Avenue Power 4 for about 11 of you. So let's do this, Kimball.
Absolutely. My goodness, so much to talk about today. The book is out and doing well, getting good reviews other than a couple of trolls here and there, but we know what they're about.
Oh, have you found some things that I haven't seen?
Well, I saw so you mentioned something that, well, although I just, somebody gave it a you know, 4 stars, which is a good review, but I thought, the hell's wrong with those people?
No. What they're doing, Kimball, these people, they're so disturbed. They are up to no good. That person is putting that out there because they want to be the first one and have something like semi-believable. So the way it really should work with this book, now that you've read it, and we'll talk about it later, but I don't think I'm really crossing a line here to say it's the type of thing that you're going to give it what it merits. You're going to give it the full Monty of the star compliment. So what you should really only see is that or the 1 star people from the trolls. It really doesn't make a lot of artistic or critical sense with the, well, it was really pretty good, but it was kind of not, that's neither really not here nor there. So you had mentioned, though, this is on the blog, and somebody had said to me, tell me about yourself. And I just think that's the laziest way to approach what ought to be an organic exchange conversation. And what's more, this is within the context of, like, you have a profile online and everything. So I've done my thing. So if you've read me doing my thing and then you're like, tell me about yourself, it's meant to be answered in, you probably love the example on the blog, right, about the bridge. It's meant to be answered. I can't say what I said in the blog in the air downtownians, but trust me, you're going to want to go to the blog and read the entry about the bridge, and you will laugh very hard. But it's true.
I don't want to do the heavy lifting of actually reading your profile, so can you just give me some of the highlights here when a truly genuine person, I would think, would not only read the profile, but then come to you with some follow-up questions.
Oh, no, that's where I think you might, this is where my experience comes into play. You haven't had to be in this particular world, probably, not too much in your life like I have. They have read it, and they're intimidated, and they're also lazy. And I give you, as you would expect, plenty to work with. But what people like to do with me, they're almost always up to no good. A lot of people are scared of me, though, and they try to play it cool. Like, yeah, I've been here. Like, if someone goes to the website for the first time, someone who is, like, just taking my first name and decided to see what comes up on the Google, and they, like, play it cool guy with me, it's like, oh, I see you do some writing. Like, come on. We both know this is, like, not kind of the normal-looking career here. And by that, I don't mean, oh, I'm a writer, and that's just very distinct. I don't even mean that. I mean what I actually do and the scope of what I do, which is immediately evident to anyone who looks at the site. So when you try and play a cool guy with me, I know a couple things about you. I know that you are either socially awkward, you're a coward, or, Patrick, you're a combo. And I move on.
All right, let's talk about a few things on our pre-established and ordained agenda here. Let's start with, I love the show. We've talked about it a lot. But this time we're talking about, I believe it's the first half-hour episode of yours truly, Johnny Dollar, Bob Bailey, stretching it out. It was an entertaining episode called The Big Scoop Matter.
So I think the way that one should probably look at the Bob Bailey, yours truly, Johnny Dollar episodes is the 5-parters are sometimes at the level of art. The half-hour episode, same show, but it could be a different show almost. They're more just like straight-up entertainment. And don't be like, oh, I don't like art. I like entertainment and binging. Because art and entertainment, they can be intertwined. They can be the same thing and bolster each other. So the 5-parters are more entertaining, too. They're not just art sometimes. But this is the first one. So they're transitioning from these 75-minute episodes to this half-hour format where there's not going to be as much in the terms of rich characterization, but it is hopping along at a pretty good pace, and you still get those pauses and those beats and those human moments. And this one is about a friend of Dollar's who he's discovered there's a gambling syndicate, like in New England. It just kind of seems a strange place for like the honcho of a gambling syndicate to be. I'm thinking Chicago or New York City or something like that. And he tracks this guy down, Dollar's friend, to this inn, like in, what is it, like New Hampshire type of place.
Right.
Or actually in upstate New York. And so it doesn't work out that well for that guy. And Dollar becomes not even really an insurance investigator during this episode, but a sleuth trying to solve a homicide. Guy gets shot in the head. He's also kind of an annoying guy, so you don't really like worry about it that much when it does happen. But the bad guy of the piece, he stays on at this bed and breakfast, which I love. He's in there in the off season, so I guess it'd be like now. And he's like, I really enjoy like being here in the off season. And he extends his like post-kill sojourn.
There are still some great Johnny Dollar elements in it. I love the conversation early on with Dollar and his friend, and he asks about the wife, and you know, we wanted different things. She wanted the moon, and Johnny Dollar says, where is she now? I guess she's headed to the moon. Just a great line.
The wife is not a great person
No.
in this episode. And we should give a shout out to, she's played by Virginia Gregg. And Virginia Gregg is the, in some ways, the star. She's essential. She's not, obviously, like Jimmy Stewart would be in, if he was in this, he'd be like Johnny Dollar. But Virginia Gregg is Donna Reed in It's a Wonderful Life type of thing, if you wanted to transpose that to this radio series. She is most of the women, it seems like, in the Bob Bailey run. And she's incredibly versatile with her voice. I don't know that you could have this series. We couldn't have it with him at this level, but you couldn't have it without her either. So the wife sucks. She's having this affair, and she doesn't really care. I said, one of the things that, there are flaws in this, obviously. One of the flaws is that even though they're splitting up or they're separated and she's out doing whatever on the town, she takes it in like perfect stride when the husband dies. Just like Dollar, his friend dies, and at the end, there's like this is very Sherlock Holmes. There's this sugar that's not wet and it doesn't get this across, and it's a hole in a roof. And that's how you find out, like, this guy, I don't know how this would hold up in court, but Dollar seems to think it's going to. And he makes this pun at the end. He's like, and come to think of it, it was pretty sweet. It's like, dude, your friend just got shot. He tells you, like, right between the eyes. And he doesn't just get shot between the eyes. His corpse is, like, wedged in a doorframe.
But it was good. It was still better than much of what's out there today. But I do prefer those 15-minute episodes.
Sure, I'm not like running it down, because if you just heard this, if this is how it was all along, this would be really great radio entertainment at the time that would hold up as entertainment now. I mean, think of something like Orson Welles in The Shadow. Now, part of the reason that we listen to that is because it's Orson Welles, but it's serviceable, solid, and like B+. And that's what these half-hour episodes are. They get kind of ropier the further you go along, where Dollar's out on the case, and someone's like, hey, you're Johnny Dollar, the insurance agent. I listen to your radio series. It's like, what? This has been a radio series all along? Like, it's never really established. And they're just like, but it's fine. We've been doing this for a long time. Because, of course, they had lots of actors playing this part before, like, Bob Bailey hit the sweet spot. But I don't know. I love Bob Bailey and everything he does. And there's this funny thing he does later in other half-hour ones where they have the phone call at the beginning. Someone says something weird to him, and then, like, they hang up. He must have improvised this. He always does something. He's like, Like, he adds, like, this weird sort of note that is, I don't know, I find myself doing things like that just in life anyway. Almost like, I wonder if I'm becoming a guy who talks to himself. But it heartens me that Bob Bailey does that, too.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. You've got a terrific new piece in Jazz Times ranking the 10 best live albums from Miles Davis. What I was drawn to right away was the image of you probably at Starbucks, reading ghost stories when your ears suddenly perk up.
I have a lot of sort of epiphanic moments at the Starbucks. I had one today when Billie Holiday came on. I was just dipping in really quickly to grab something. And I have this rule that I won't leave until Billie Holiday, it's not like I'm playing a full album, it's like a 3.5 minute song. I won't leave until she's done. But I remember I'd written one last year where we'd spoken about Duke Ellington at Christmas time, and it was when there were no tables in the Starbucks. And for some reason, I got into this like zone. It's like, okay, you're a hoofer. It's time to do some dance moves. And Ellington came on in the Nutcracker Suite, and I was like sort of moving about, and then I caught myself and caught people looking at me and thinking I was a freak. And so, yes, I was there reading Edwardian Ghost Stories, and Miles Davis, the studio album, Porgy and Bess, came on. And it's just, you're hearing all this other stuff, and it's oral wallpaper. And obviously, this isn't a live recording, but I just thought about Davis, like, that encapsulates this, just this other level. It's just so different. It stands out right away. Of course, no one else even looked up or noticed it, but I noticed it. And that got me thinking about his live albums, because Davis had this run where one time he was like going to something at the White House, some award ceremony. It's like the only black person there. He's in the backseat of this limo. And this like white dowager type, this old woman, she's like, "What have you done? Why are you here?" And he says something like, "Well, I only changed the history of music like 7 times, MF-er." He's like, "Oh no, what am I going to do?" So you really get that sense of the change over the course of his live discography from the 50s on through. I stopped in the 70s because I feel like he tailed off after 75. But you get all these different genres and pockets and movements and really those changes that he was speaking about.
And so your criteria for ranking these albums, is it based on the impact they had on the larger music, not just on what he was doing, but how it changed music?
A lot of times what I do is I'm just doing it for the piece. I'm doing it for how it actually comes together as a work of writing. I don't even think it really like matters necessarily. Like this is 7th and this is 4th. I'm looking at it sometimes because you have to be wise about it, because you could have things that are from the same year and you can't put them back to back in a list like this. Nobody's going to say that to you, but I'll be honest about it. You have to balance it as its own reading experience, because ultimately that's what I want people to take away, the ideas and the language and that kind of thing, which might sound weird maybe, because I just don't do like, certainly the Sam Cooke book wasn't, I don't do like, oh, here's some music writing that's about this other art, and that's what you should check out. You always want to be, when you're writing, you always want to be, if you're good enough, the main show. And then people can take what they take and they get all of this knowledge and whatever. And I do think, though, my number one choice certainly was Miles Davis at the Plug Nickel, which was this club in Chicago, and this extended run, this residency he does, which I just think would have been so cool. The Grateful Dead did it in rock and roll, where you'd be the de facto house band for a week. And I'm going to be doing a book about that, where you can look at American music changing in the history of American music changing within these extended residencies by certain people. So the Davis Plug Nickel set will be a big part of that. It'll be a big section of that. And it's his second great quintet, and they've been together for a while throughout that year and some of the year before, but they're really gelling around Christmas time, 65. And it's just recorded with this fidelity that's the best you're going to get. It puts you right in that Chicago room, and the flights of extemporization are just, I mean, it's just the sort of Baroque chamber music, ultimate avant-garde, but popular, accessible jazz that you're ever going to get.
Do you find when you listen that you are absolutely transported, that you're there in the winter of 1965 and experiencing what is happening, and oh, it's night two, what are we going to do tonight to shake people up?
Sure, and you can imagine, I just love recordings like this, you can imagine that, I don't know, pick whatever scenario you want, you're a grad student at the University of Chicago, and you're going to each of these sets, because some people must have done that. There must have been like 7 people who did that.
Right.
And you're hearing them handle whatever it is, Autumn Leaves, One Time Away, that they're not going to try another time. And this is such an exciting band because Davis was particularly jazzed by these guys were, I mean, they weren't that much younger than him, but you know how you look at age when you're certain ages where like different years count for different amounts of things. And Davis has been around. He was like a veteran. It's almost like in a baseball team. It's like someone's 31 years old. They're not that much older than the person who's 24, but they've been in the league for maybe 10 years. So it's like the old salt. And Miles Davis was the old salt. And the driver of the band is really Tony Williams, the drummer. And Davis was just charged up by what this guy could do. I mean, he's practically a teenager, Tony Williams, at this point. So it was interesting that Davis, because he didn't really have another unit. I mean, he had great drummers, of course. But I don't think he had another unit where, like, Davis looked as the main, to the main guy being the drummer, Wunderkind.
Am I wrong in this? I look at jazz particularly as an art form where the musicians involved, not that they disregard the listeners and the fans, but they get more, I'll use the pun, they get more jazzed at the idea of exciting and challenging each other than anything else.
Well, you have to, in a sense. Think of it like, to put it in sports terms, think about hockey, where everything that you do on the ice, like a top-level forward line. Think of like that Soviet line of Krutov and Larionov and Makarov. Everything they do is in response to each other. Everything that they anticipate and respond to, but especially anticipate. Like, I know this guy, he's going to be over here, and then maybe he extemporizes off of that, and there's a bang pass off the boards. And that's very much what jazz is. It's not just playing, it's actively listening to what your fellows are doing. And I was speaking to someone recently about there's a huge difference between hearing and listening. And Davis is, he's a master listener. It almost reminds me, if you remember the 2013 World Series when David Ortiz, he hits something ridiculous like 750. And of course he wins the World Series MVP. But I remember when he was taking pitches, I could like feel him seeing the ball, how well he was seeing it. He didn't move the bat. And I feel like Miles Davis listens to these guys like he was David Ortiz at the plate in the 2013 World Series. So there's a lot happening at once. And then you're not just playing in real time, you're writing in real time. These guys are writing like right in front of you. Remember that Picasso and that Jackson Pollock, they're those short films where it's like, okay, here's Pollock with his drip on glass, and he's painting in front of you. And that's what these guys are doing. They're like trying to get writing right in this like one continuous in your presence take.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Well, let's slide on in to the sports world. And we've been having an online conversation about fielding in Major League Baseball and errors in the history of fielding records, and it's fascinating. We've both been having a great time looking back at the transformation of errors in fielding in Major League Baseball going back to the pre-1900 era.
Errors are awesome. Errors make no sense statistically by modern metrics. I found another one. So you kind of kicked this off when you mentioned Honus Wagner, and I think most people who know baseball history have Honus Wagner, shortstop, famous T206 baseball card, in their top 10 of best players ever. And what did he have? 826 errors? He's over 800.
Right.
And so, but he's also like 44th in all-time defensive war. And if people out there don't know what that means, what people want you to think it means is that he's like the 44th best defender of all time. So I was going season by season with him last night, because that's an awful lot of errors. And so, but he's still not part of an exclusive club that we'll get to. He had a year where he has like 39 errors. He leads the league in errors. He also leads the league in defensive war. So the guy who makes the most errors in the entire sport is proclaimed by modern metrics as he was also the best fielder. It's like it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was day and night at the same time if you were playing against Honus Wagner. But put it this way. You hit a bounder to shortstop, you should run that out, because you have a pretty good chance of nailing, reaching first base for yourself if Honus Wagner was there at the sixth spot.
And part of that, there was so much going on. You've got baseballs that are dirty and covered with spit and coffee grounds and dirt and grass stains. They're not replacing those balls after every foul that's hit. You've got fields that are in terrible shape. And then you've got gloves that are, well, they're not really gloves at all.
I have a ripped, disgusting, sagging Cape Cod League sweatshirt on right now. And I had just gone out to get some mushrooms for my blood pressure before you called. And then there's just stains everywhere. That's what a baseball would have looked like.
Yeah.
When the baseball went into the stands, like when you're a kid, little help, like they would have thrown the ball back. And so the field is strewn with rocks. It's not like, it's interesting because I saw on YouTube a game from Fenway. It was like 20 years ago the other day. You could see spots of brown and like just these kind of dead patches of grass. It's quite different even than it is right now. And this was like the 90s. So imagine how this was in 1910. And then I think the biggest thing is the gloves. And you just go online and type in like old baseball glove or Hall of Fame exhibit, old glove, 1910. It's like a glove in the sense of it's cold out. These are my gloves. Rather than here's the thing with webbing and I'm going to do this stuff with it. It's really no wonder that like some guy like Rogers Hornsby would go and for like 424 and hit at that kind of batting average level, because I don't know how it would have been, you know, when like Rafael Devers comes in on one of those chops to third base and it's a do or die type of play. He has to bare hand it or he has no chance. These guys were essentially fielding rockets that way, as if the glove is more like padding than like an extension of your hand.
And you better field the ball with two hands, because it's not going to, there is no webbing for it to stick in.
Do you ever see, and it carried on for quite a while, but like an old catcher's mitt, or even like when Johnny Bench broke into the league, so that's 1968, it didn't have the segments.
Do right.
You see what I'm saying? Like
right.
It was just like this round kind of like muffin that you tried to catch the ball with. So you had to catch as a catcher with two hands. So even that's like after Monterey Pop, people are still catching that way. It's like fairly recent-ish. I know people don't look at it that way now, but in like the grand scope of history, that's very recent history, which brings us to our man, Deacon White, who I really enjoy. If ever there was a guy who looked like his name, it's Deacon White. Deacon White is so cool. He is going to commit. It's one of four guys. This is so impressive. In the Thousand Error Club. But he was really good, this Deacon White. He was actually played for the Boston Red Stockings. He hails from 1847, so I'm not sure if he did, but Deacon White might have had a turn in the Civil War. It's like, oh, now that the war is behind us and we did all that liberating, maybe a career in baseball is for me. What do you think, Dad? But you ever see that show, The Young Riders, that Western show?
Oh, sure, yeah.
He looks like he's out of central casting for The Young Riders, doesn't he? Like, when you have that time when you're watching a show and there's a photographer and they're cowboys and it's like 1861 or whatever, and you didn't even know there was photography and it takes them like 10 minutes to take a photo. Deacon White, he stepped out of that photo and he made an absolute mountain full of errors as a catcher.
Yeah, my favorite stat is from 1876, when he made 64 errors in 63 games.
Oh yeah, how about the guy Herman Long, and who set the single season record, which was tied. So two different dudes did this with 122 errors, and I was thinking about that. His fielding percentage must have been like 50%. Like
right.
It's like shooting three. It's like shooting threes if you're really good, Steph Curry.
And our conversation about this started with today with Hunter Renfroe, who has put together this bizarro world season where he leads all of Major League Baseball in assists, but has also made an unheard of, what is it now, 12 errors in the outfield?
Hunter Renfroe, yeah, I have some thoughts on that. Hunter Renfroe, he decided before the season he wanted to be like a Gold Glove guy. And so figured his best route to that trophy, that award, was throwing people out. And I feel like if you have a really good arm in the outfield, you shouldn't have that many assists. Like, guys aren't running on you. But when they do run on you, they think, ah, probably be fine. You end up, like, nabbing some people. it's almost like a cornerback in football. Like, if you have a lot of interceptions, it's because people think they can throw on you. So I remember Ty Law, like, he'd get key interceptions for the Patriots, but then he goes to the Jets, and he's, like, clearly overweight. And he's like, I will lead the league with 10 interceptions. It's like, because people thought they could pick on you.
Right.
And eventually some hit your hands, and that worked out well. Hunter Renfro, that's an obscene amount of errors for a right field nowadays. I mean, once upon a time in 1910, there would have been like a Salem witch trial to test if you were like a member of the human species. Like, what do you mean he only has 12 errors? I have 10 times more than that, and I'm a great player in this league. I might get the copper jug as the MVP.
Is that what they gave? Was it the copper jug?
I figured they'd give you like a jug or an axe or like, I don't know, a year's supply of acorns.
Right, a brand new spittoon.
Right. I mean, there's no way. There's no way that Deacon White was not a man who failed to enjoy his chaw. I mean, really, listeners, you need to go look up like Deacon White. He might as well. I mean, maybe that's where his name comes from. I don't know. He very well could have been like a deacon because he looks like he's going to give you a stern talking to on how you shouldn't have like fire water on Sundays. He's not like, I don't know. It seems like a guy that you'd be having a lot of merriment with necessarily.
No, absolutely not. All right. We're talking with Colin Fleming. And finally, we want to talk about the concept of gunning. Can you explain what that means?
Oh, sure. It's what we were talking about there a little bit at the start when, so I put that thing up on the blog where you see the woman who, so she sees my profile, reads all this like, ooh, fancy, English is good, and she gives me a grade. Like, we both know what that's about, you know what I mean? That's someone, you know when someone's gunning for you. I deal with it all the time because what people like to do, people who fancy themselves as intelligent or intellectuals, who aren't secure in themselves, they like to try to measure themselves against me. And it's just not going to go the way that they want it to. So they will open often with this salvo, with a shot. And I know that they're gunning for me right away. It's like, oh, you obviously like words a lot. Well, that's a left-handed compliment. Like 9 out of 10 on ideas. And then I serve them up, Kimball, and I provided the translation. We've talked about this before, but I love it. If I say great, comma, good luck to you, that means, like, I really hate you. That's code for you are the worst. I have no respect for you whatsoever. I don't want harm to befall you, but if I learned about it, I wouldn't exactly be gutted. Please never contact me or darken my phone or my inbox ever, ever. So help me again, ever.
Do people respond to that, or do they take the message and go away?
Oh, it's funny. You can get all kinds of things. Some of them are like, lol. Others are like, what do you mean? Like, yeah, I don't know how else to make that clear for you. Or the geniuses who just, they're upset they can't have this fight, which is what they're there for. They will say, good luck with what? I don't know. Being a socially awkward misfit who's like, life is a giant abyss of nullity? And then, of course, Kimball, they don't like that, and I have to be careful. He's like, I'm going to get him! And then, like, they go out, like, oh! And then they learn I do all these things, and it's like, I hate him even more! I'm going to get him! So I have to sort of, like, mitigate against that. That's why I go with the great good luck. If I say great good luck to you, I mean, there are people I say worse things to, but great good luck is just, that's not what you want to be getting from the Sea Dog.
Keep that in mind. If you say that to me at some point, I'll understand exactly where I stand in the cosmos.
Well, this one was bad enough that I shaved it down. I just gave it good luck. But, I mean, you, listeners, you can go see it on the blog. I screenshotted that bad boy. You can tell, like, uh-oh. Like, I remember one time I was with my friend, and we were road tripping, like we were in college, and his door wouldn't open. And we had to pay these, like, his window wouldn't open, rather. And we come to, like, a toll booth, and he starts to get out to pay the toll guy. And you can see the look on the toll guy's face of like, uh-oh, here comes trouble. Because why are you getting out, like, on the Mass Pike? So you can see these people. It's like, oh, here we go. You know what they're up to. And I experience it every day. I almost always have to ask, okay, what is it? It's like, they're not up to any good. I can tell what's going on here.
9 out of 10 with your words, Colin. Fine job, as always.
Yeah, I figured as a teacher, you would would appreciate 9 out of 10 on ideas. I guarantee you, Kimball, I mean, because I don't even have to check anymore. I have so much, like, experience with this. I guarantee you anything. She was, like, an academic, and she went to, like, this Ivy League school. It's always the same. I mean, there's never, like, I worked my way up by my bootstraps, and this is what, no. It's always, always, always the same. And as your man Bruce Pratt noted, yeah, she probably went to Exeter.
Colin Fleming. Get your hands on his new book, which we'll talk about extensively next week on the segment. It is Sam Cooke, live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. And as I said to you, Colin, it stands as a work of art right there with the man Sam Cooke himself. It's powerful stuff that takes you to that magical place and time. So we'll check in with you again next Tuesday.
All right, sounds good, bye.
Colin Fleming on Downtown.